The singer wrote about the school's academic problems in general and the ease with which players sailed through their classes in particular, the tremendous pressure placed on the coaching staff to win, and the grueling workouts the players endured. But what caused the greatest fury were Bissinger's allegations of racism. He cited Permian's failure to integrate its student body until 1983, and quoted a coach who referred to a black player as a big old dumb nigger. Residents had hoped that Bissinger would write something similar to Hoosiers, an uplifting movie about high school basketball in rural Indiana. Instead, he made the entire town, as one longtime resident says, look like a bunch of obsessed, racist rednecks. Bissinger, who lived in Odessa for a year while he worked on the book, continues to see its virtues. To not write those things would have been a dereliction of duty, he told me. The book was hard when it had to be, but clearly at the root of it was a love for those kids playing football and a real affection for the town. Others don't. It was a novel, says Randy Mays, who has been the Panthers' head coach since 1994 and was an assistant under Gary Gaines in 1988. Buzz will do anything to sensationalize, and he needed to make a dollar. Mays believes that Bissinger saw some terrible traits in the community, things that no one would deny existed, but made the mistake of ascribing them to the team. There were certain aspects of Odessa that appalled Buzz. He attributed them to racism, but that never existed in this fieldhouse. Mays read only a few pages when it came out, and he didn't come back to it until a year or so ago. Gaines never read it at all. My wife did, and she called me on the phone crying, he says. She told me the nuts and bolts of it. Almost a decade later, the charges still sting. When I visited Odessa in August, with two-a-days in full swing, people were eager to talk to me when I told them I was working on a story about high school football. But when I mentioned those three words, Friday Night Lights, in almost every instance their faces stiffened and I was met with more than one extended pause, as though I had asked about an uncle who was serving time in the state pen. Younger Odessans seemed aware of the book, but most hadn't read it, though one relatively recent Permian graduate who works at a local bookstore said, in a somewhat hushed tone, I don't care what anybody else around here thinks. It's a great book. What about the players who lived it? Many appear on the following pages, but they tell their stories similar to those of any high school graduates. Some have finished college and done well. Others have struggled. A few have found the American dream, a wife and family, a nice house, a steady job. And what of Permian High itself? As the class of 2000 begins its senior year, little has changed. Football remains sacred, young boys dream of wearing the black and white, and on the turf of Ratliff Stadium, heroes are still crowned beneath the Friday night lights. Brian Chavez. In the now iconic photo on the cover of Friday Night Lights, Chavez, number 85, is the man in the middle. But everything else he did at Permian put him on top. He was team captain and started as both tight end and defensive end. And he was the salutatorian of his class. Since then, he dreamed of being accepted to Harvard, and he was. After graduating with honors in 1993 with a B.A. in government, Chavez returned to Texas and earned a law degree at Texas Tech. Now, he is a criminal defense attorney at the Odessa law firm started by his father, Tony. What he remembers about that season. On the final drive in our loss against Dallas Carter in the semifinals, I ran a 2-3-6-A dunk. The ball was thrown perfectly, and if I'd caught it, I would have scored the winning touchdown. But at the last second, Jesse Armstead came out of nowhere and touched the ball just enough to knock it away. His opinion of the book? It was a pretty true assessment of race in Odessa. As for how it described playing at Permian, Buzz hit it right on the nose. When I think about my senior year, I couldn't describe it any better. Chad and Tracy Payne. They were high school sweethearts who started dating the summer before their senior year. He was a starting linebacker. She never missed a game. Since then, they married in June 1990 and chose to remain in Odessa, where she studied accounting at Odessa College, and he supported them by working for his dad at Seacoast Marine. Now, he's a foreman at West Tex Seal. She's an accountant at Cumulus Broadcasting. They have two daughters, Brittany, who is 8, and McKaylee, who is 6, and they still have season tickets to Panther games. What he remembers about that season? The big one we lost against Carter. You know how those bad memories stick in your mind? But I don't think they were the best team we played. Marshall was, and that was another close game we lost. Their opinion of the book. Tracy, we were most upset about the negative impression it gave the football team and the whole town. Chad, having Buzz down here made you feel more important than you were. People put too much trust in him. Gary Gaines. In Gaines' first season as head coach, Permian won 7 games but failed to make the playoffs. Fans responded by planting for sale signs in his yard. 3 years later, though, all was forgiven. In 1989, the Panthers went undefeated, bringing home the school's 5th state championship trophy and earning the title of national champs. Since then, in 1990, Gaines became an assistant at Texas Tech. He returned to high school game in 1994 when he took over at Abilene High. Now, in his 29th year of coaching, he's the head coach at Central High School in San Angelo. What he remembers about that season. We finished the regular season tied with Midland High and Midland Lee, but only 2 teams could go to the playoffs. I drove to a truck stop in the middle of the night, met the other coaches, and we flipped a coin to see who was out. As I recall, my coin ended up on the other side of the room. Man, was I glad it came up that way. His opinion of the book. Buzz said he wanted to write about how football brought a community together, and I'm disappointed that he failed to focus on the positive aspects of the program. I don't have any apologies to make for that team, and I enjoyed coaching in Odessa. James Booby Miles. Miles was going to be the Panthers' star running back his senior year, and he was recruited by such schools as UCLA, Notre Dame, and Oklahoma. But a career-ending injury in a meaningless preseason game wrecked those dreams. In frustration, he would quit the team with just 1 game left in the regular season. Since then, he tried to play ball at Ranger Junior College, but he wasn't the same athlete. He has looked for work in Dallas and Atlanta, but something always leads me back to Odessa, he says. Now, he's a maintenance worker at a friend's barbershop. He and his wife, Shalay, have 2 children, Jatasha, who is 3, and Joe Angel, who is 2. They are expecting twins in December. What he remembers about that season? The play during that scrimmage against Palladura, the one that busted my knee. You know, it's still killing me. I just wanted to play football, go to Nebraska, and make the NFL. Now, I regret the whole thing. His opinion of the book? I think Buzz put it down just like people said it, and I think a lot of people were surprised they got quoted. Don Billingsley. After growing up in Oklahoma with his mother, Billingsley moved to Odessa to live with his father after his freshman year in high school. He did it, he says, so he could play football for Permian. He wanted to be a Panther tailback, just as his dad had been in the 60s. My whole family went to Permian, he says. Since then, he attended East Central Oklahoma State University in Ada, where he earned a bachelor's degree in public relations and a master's in counseling. Now, in April, he married his girlfriend, Melanie Fannin, and they moved to Dallas, where he works as a mental health counselor. What he remembers about that season? After we beat San Angelo in the final regular season game, some of the guys on the bus ride back had radios, so we listened to the coin toss. All the work that went into that season, all of those hours spent at the fieldhouse and going to the playoffs, came down to that. We were tense, nervous, and quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And when we found out, everybody just went nuts. His opinion of the book. I'm glad that Buzz wrote it. For him to just focus on five or six guys, or for him to choose me, I feel really fortunate. It's like living an annual. Of course, he didn't get everything right. I fumbled only twice that season. Jared McDougal, a bruising, undersized offensive tackle, McDougal played with more heart than anyone. And as a famous picture from the book shows, no one took the loss to Midland Lee more personally. Since then, for a few years afterward, he said, I just isolated myself and buried my head in the sand. In fact, he did what a lot of people thought he'd do. He went to work at his father's company, M&P Construction, which is based in Crane. Now, this spring, he moved to Bandera to work at Roger Stevens, a soil conservation company his father recently acquired. He takes night classes when he can, and one day he hopes to become a coach. What he remembers about that season. At the Carter game, the officials in Austin asked if we wanted ball dryers. Ball dryers. We never had to have ball dryers. It never rains in Odessa. So hard-headed Gaines told them, no, we don't need them. Carter got all our dryers, and the ball weighed like 50 pounds. Our quarterback couldn't throw it. His opinion of the book? I didn't want Buzz there. As flattering as it was, he was a distraction. I'd heard that it was going to be controversial, so the first time I read it, all I looked for were lies. But I couldn't find one. I cried the whole way through it.
Look out, football! Here we come! Houston Oilers number one!
Houston has the Oilers, the greatest football team. We take the ball from goal to goal like no one's ever seen.
Here's an article from the October 21st, 2013 issue of Texas Monthly entitled 11 Remembrances of Bum Phillips, 1923 to 2013. I heard about Bum Phillips' death on Friday night via a social media friend who uploaded a classic photo, big white Stetson, powder blue jacket, of the legendary former Houston Oilers coach to Instagram and Facebook. She's a Cowboys fan. Everybody loved Bum Phillips, a man who, as the Houston Chronicle's David Barron wrote in his obituary, spent half his adult life as a football coach and every waking moment as the personification of all things Texan. The Orange Native's death was not merely that of a football great or a great Houstonian, but that of a great Texas icon, as surely as Willie, LBJ, or Gus McCray. As Texas Monthly's Joe Nick Petoskey noted in 1991, Phillips was voted one of the all-time top 10 Texans in a Houston Post poll. Behind Sam Houston, Stephen F. Austin, George Bush, Nolan Ryan, and Red Adair, but ahead of Lyndon Johnson, Barbara Jordan, Willie Nelson, and Earl Campbell. It's been said that if Phillips and Lyndon B. Johnson walked into a room at the same time, no one would doubt that old Bum was a big shot, Brian D. Sweeney wrote in the Texas Monthly's September 2002 football issue, which found Phillips at his Goliad Ranch for a photo shoot with Texas Tech's Spike Dykes and Texas A&M's R.C. Slocum. A mere 62 years old when he retired in the 80s, as the Chronicle's Dale Robertson noted, his son, former Cowboys coach and current Houston Texans defensive coordinator Wade Phillips, is already 67. Bum finished out his life as a true Cowboy. I've got three places I lease, he told Petoskey. I don't own them. I just coached. I didn't play. If I'd have played, I'd have bought them. Phillips and his wife Debbie also created a charitable foundation in 2010 with a focus on American Sign Language education and Christian ministries. According to the Port Arthur News, Phillips will be buried under an oak tree at his ranch. A public memorial will be held in Houston on October 29th at Lakewood Church, fittingly a former Houston sports venue, if not quite the dome. Below, 11 sides of Bum from all across the internet. Love you, Blue. John Clayton of ESPN wrote that the Oilers' rivalry with the Pittsburgh Steelers was like Allie Frazier, except Joe Frazier got to win one. As the Chronicle's Robertson suggested, Phillips, who coached the Oilers from 1975 to 1980, remains the only coach in these parts, or probably any parts, who got to experience back-to-back season-ending defeats that would be followed by the same night by back-to-back standing-room-only crowds of cheering fans. Imagine that juxtaposed against the current angst about the Texans' failures. It was as much love you bum as it was love you blue in 1978-79 when the Oilers twice reached the NFL's American Conference Championship game before losing in Pittsburgh to the Steelers, a storied franchise with a roster full of Hall of Fame-bound players that won 4 Super Bowls during the 6 years Phillips was with the Oilers. But such was the special synergy between a town, a team, and a homespun, tobacco-chewing, homily-spewing coach that more than 60,000 twice turned out for rowdy Astrodome pep rallies held to welcome Bum and his boys home. The quotable Bum. Last year we knocked on the door. This year we beat on it. Next year we're going to kick the sumbitch in, Phillips said after the 79 season. It was not to be. He was fired in 1980, something Houston could ultimately never forgive Oilers owner Bub Adams for, until Adams dreamt up something even worse by decamping to Tennessee. Other classic Bum lines. I always thought I could coach. I just thought people were poor judges of good coaches. The Dallas Cowboys may be America's team, but the Houston Oilers are Texas's team. I don't mind being called bum, just as long as you don't put you in front of it. I'm not saying Earl Campbell is in a class by himself, but whatever class he's in, it don't take long to call the roll. Shula or Bear? Bum's most famous and most folksy line is this one. He can take his'n and beat your'n, but he can't take your'n and beat his'n. It's most frequently cited in reference to former Miami Dolphins coach Don Shula, but both the New York Times and Buck Harvey of the San Antonio Express News note that Phillips said it about Bear Bryant first. The Family Man. Wade Phillips, whose Twitter handle is @sonofbum, shared the news of his father's passing Friday night. He was able to spend time with Bum before heading off to Kansas City for Sunday's Texans game. He also had nice things to say about his followers' reactions. We received prayers, condolences, and tributes for Bum that celebrate his life rather than mourn his passing. Some say social media is negative, but thousands have consoled our family at this tough time in our lives. Thanks to you all for your kindness and support for my family at this time. Bum is gone to heaven loved, and we will be missed by all great dad, coach, and Christian. Bum Phillips Charities also reposted this picture on Facebook of Bum with his 5 daughters. The Mid-County Legend. In 1991, TM's Potoski noted that Phillips was the only head football coach to direct Texas teams on the high school, college, and professional levels. His high school stops included Amarillo, Jacksonville, and most notably Nederland and Port Neches Groves. The two schools were playing in the Mid-County rivalry game for the 90th time on Friday night when Phillips passed. 2 years ago, he had been honored at the game when the two cities jointly renamed a street Bum Phillips Way. A Lamar and Stephen F. Austin graduate himself, Phillips was the head coach at Texas Western in 1962, as well as an assistant to Bryant at A&M, to Hayden Fry at SMU, and to Bill Yeoman at the University of Houston. Damn Yankees. Up north, folks just couldn't help but act a little silly about Bum being so Texan, even if they only said nice things. The New York Times obit by Richard Goldstein, led with a description of Phillips as the homespun Texan who was caricatured as a cowboy but possessed a keen football mind. One would be mistaken to assume that Phillips, who passed away on Friday at the age of 90, was all hat and no cattle, wrote Doug Farr of SI.com. And Ray Didinger of CSN Philadelphia recalled a line from NFL Films president Steve Sabol, who said, "Bum looked like a square dance caller, but if you check the record, he took over a couple of bad teams and won a lot of games." Bless their hearts. The 3-4 Innovator. Farrer's story actually gives full credit to Phillips as a brilliant defensive innovator and strategist. Not only did Phillips pioneer the most lasting, high-pressure version of the 3-4 defense, but he also gave Bryant the idea for defensive front numbering when he was still at the high school level. Anyone running a version of the 3-4 defense in the modern NFL is Bum Phillips' offspring to some degree, Farr wrote. Gene Brammel of the footballguys.com and the New York Times broke down the vagaries of the 3-4 in 2010, noting that the Oilers' fearsome star pass-rushing linebacker Robert Brazil, Dr. Doom, was LT before Lawrence Taylor came into the league. The movie star. Didinger and Steve Sabol played a large role in the making of this 2003 NFL Films documentary about Phillips and the Oilers, which is full of priceless archival footage, starting with the 1978 training camp in San Angelo. It ain't over till the football coach sings. As many fans already know, there is an opera about Phillips in the works from composer Peter Stopchinski, Grupo Fantasma, Golden Horn Project, and librettist Kirk Lynn, Austin's Rude Mex Theater Company. Bum Phillips' All-American Opera is based on his autobiography, Bum Phillips, Cowboy, Coach, Christian, and is set for a New York premiere in March 2014. The creator's goal is to explore how a man finds resilience and faith in failure, and how a single passion fueled an entire city's hope. All native Texans, this dynamic team seeks to push the boundaries of what opera can be, as well as both where and for whom it is staged, while bridging a gap between arts, culture, and sports culture. What it means to be a Texan. Can you say meme? This essay, purportedly by Phillips, has been widely circulated online for some years. It name-checks everyone from Willie and LBJ to Michael Dell and Denton Cooley, while asking, when was the last time you went to a person's house in New York and you saw a big map of New York on their wall? When William Barrett Travis wrote in 1836 that he would never surrender and he would have victory or death, what he was really saying was that he and his men were forged of a hotter fire. They weren't your average, everyday men. Well, that is what it means to be a Texan. It meant it then, and that's why it means it today. It means just what all those people north of the Red River accuse us of thinking it means. It means there's no mountain that we can't climb. It means that we can swim the Gulf in the winter. It means that Earl Campbell ran harder, and Houston is bigger, and Dallas is richer, and Alpine is hotter, and Stevie Ray was smoother, and God vacations in Texas. It's actually someone named Bob Wheeler from a 2003 self-published book. But the fact that so many Texans want to think it's by Bum Phillips certainly says something about Texans and Bum Phillips. The burger. One last note from the TM archives. In 2009, the coach reminisced about his favorite burger to John Spong. You can't get the burger anymore, but for Bum, it was not really about the avocado, cheese, and bacon. When I was coaching the Oilers, we used to go to a place in Rosenberg that put avocado, cheese, and bacon on its burgers, and that was pretty good. It was near where I kept my cutting horses on FM 359. It was called Friends, which was the right name for it because that's what the people there were. Friends. A fast food place just fixes a burger. They just want to sell it to you. Friends wanted you to enjoy it. So we went all the time, and we took anybody who we were close with, Dan Pastorini, Kenny Stabler. They had steaks and everything else you could want, but I wanted a hamburger. Here's an article from the January 21st, 2013 issue of Texas Monthly entitled Earl Campbell's Third Act. Sports Illustrated catches up with the former Houston Oilers running back, painting an affecting portrait of the Tyler Rose, who overcame substance abuse addiction in 2009. We didn't need the Where Are They Now issue of Sports Illustrated to know where Earl Campbell is. But Lee Jenkins' cover story is an affecting portrait of the Tyler Rose, who sunk into both physical decline and chemical dependence before getting sober in 2009, and the strong bond he formed with his two sons, Tyler and Christian. Jenkins starts his story by recounting Campbell's legendary power, one priceless recollection, the time Earl barreled into Bevo, a story you can also find in Jan Reed's 2001 Texas Monthly profile of Campbell. "I hit him in the left flank," he said. "Bevo went down, a cameraman went down, and I did too. The impact didn't knock the massive steer all the way over, but the longhorn staggered and may have gone down on his haunches. Badly startled, he swung far around, yanking his handler along. Before I knew it, I was all up on Bevo," Campbell recalled to Reed. "But I didn't mean to. I couldn't stop." He looks me over for a moment, then chuckles. He said, "Moo." Former Oilers safety Bob Eason told Jenkins about trying to tackle Campbell at the goal line when the latter was playing his final season in the NFL as a New Orleans Saint. Both men ended up flat on the ground. Campbell scored the touchdown, of course, with Eason getting the worst of it. "Earl was lying right next to me. He reached his hand over to help me up, and I said, 'Earl, I've got to lie here a while. I think you knocked out my eyes,'" said Eason, who actually lost his contact lenses from the hit. But the story is really about Earl's fall, and happily, his comeback. Campbell's teammates didn't know why he retired at 30 until they saw him at 40, Jenkins wrote. He had bone spurs, gout, arthritis, and diabetes. Even as he rebuilt his company, Earl Campbell Meat Products, which had gone bankrupt around the time of Reed's story, he had to stop playing golf and was frequently in a wheelchair. Eventually, he became addicted to painkillers, first Tylenol with codeine, and then OxyContin. "I stay focused and prayerful that I won't have to deal with the situation of Earl Campbell one day," former Heisman winner and one season Houston Oiler before the move to Tennessee, Eddie George said, after meeting him during a celebration at Barton Creek Country Club for the 30th anniversary of Campbell's trophy. It was when Campbell's son Tyler was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis that Earl finally faced up to his own problems after a family intervention and a 44-day stint in rehab, longer than the prescribed 28 by choice. Among those helping him with an encouraging word was former Cowboy and Austin native Thomas Hollywood Henderson, who had battled his own substance abuse demons. Campbell has since had the knee replacement and can get around with a walker as he walks out of the University of Texas campus, where he is a special assistant to athletic director DeLoss Dodds, hoping to become pain-free enough to swing the golf clubs once again. 9 holes would suffice. He and Tyler work together on Earl Campbell Meat Products, and they're considering opening up another barbecue restaurant after a failed first attempt.
The joint investigation between SMU and the NCAA has concluded that between September of 1985 and December of 1986, monthly payments ranging from $50 to $725 were made to numerous student-athletes. The sanctions levied against SMU go beyond the one-year death penalty. The NCAA has tacked on another 2 years to its current probationary period. SMU will be on probation until September 1st of 1990. And the university has been instructed to conduct annual audits of...
Here's a football article from the December 2010 issue of Texas Monthly entitled, Beating a Dead Horse. Nearly 25 years after SMU received the death penalty, the Mustangs are finally on the trail to success. But an ESPN documentary reminds us how far the team had fallen thanks to ego, greed, and the religion of football. For many college football teams, two consecutive bowl games and a conference championship berth represent a program that is on the move. For SMU, it's nothing short of miraculous. That's because the Mustangs, who played in the CUSA title game earlier this month and are headed to the Bell Helicopter Armed Forces Bowl on December 30th, are the only team in history to receive the death penalty from the NCAA. The cancellation of the entire 1987 season because of repeated rule violations. That punishment, which forced the school to cancel the 1988 season as well, is the subject of Pony Express, a film about the high-flying success of the football program in the early 80s and its disastrous end. The documentary premieres Saturday evening after the Heisman Trophy presentation, and it is the last film in ESPN's stellar 30 for 30 documentary series. The timing couldn't be better. College football has been reeling from allegations that Cecil Newton, the father of Auburn quarterback Cam Newton, and the frontrunner for this year's Heisman, asked for money to ensure his son would go to another school. Some things never change. Still, Newton's scheme would seem tame in Pony Express, which shows how cheating was practically a way of life in the 1980s era Southwest Conference. Director Thaddeus D. Matula, who has deep roots at SMU, shows how big money from the oil and banking industries thrust the city into the national spotlight, using Dallas's Bobby Ewing, also known as Patrick Duffy, as the narrator is certainly a nice touch. Soon, those high rollers wanted something else to brag about, a powerhouse football team. So like any other project in the city, its high-rises, its museums, its sprawling mansions, they threw money at it. As a result, the film lets us hear about recruits offered $20,000 to sign with SMU and turning it down, saying, "Coach, that's not even close." Future NFL Hall of Famer Eric Dickerson finds a gold Trans Am in the driveway of his Sealy home days before he spurned Texas A&M and signed with the Mustangs. Once at SMU, Dickerson paired with Craig James to form the famed Pony Express backfield, which led the team to a pair of Southwest Conference championships in 1981 and 1982 and put the Mustangs in contention for a national title. Both Dickerson and James appear in the film, but neither gives any indication of any wrongdoing during their time at the school, a fact that will have longtime critics grousing once more. The movie's best gotcha moment comes from a 1986 clip from Dallas's WFAA-TV as sports anchor Dale Hansen, along with producers John Sparks and Mike Capps, confront SMU recruiting coordinator Henry Lee Parker. Hansen slides an envelope with Parker's initials, bearing the SMU school seal, and addressed to player David Stanley across the table. Parker's reaction and stumbling attempts at explanation are as damning as any evidence the NCAA uncovered. The story moves quickly, propelled along with commentary by a who's who of Dallas sports media, Hanson, Randy Galloway, Skip Bayless, Norm Hitzkes, Brad Sham, Chuck Cooperstein, and Vern Lundquist. Mutula tracks down people from all sides of the story, from former players and coaches to boosters, administrators, and NCAA investigators. About the only major player not represented through film clips or interviews is Dallas real estate developer Sherwood E. Blount, Jr. Blount was the main provider for the slush fund SMU used to pay players and recruits, and is credited with telling school administrators that they couldn't stop payments because they had a payroll to meet. Blount was featured on the cover of Texas Monthly's October 1979 issue. The director's connection to the story is intriguing. Mutula was an 8-year-old Mustangs fan when his team got the death penalty. His dad has been a professor at the school since the 70s. The film features a brief clip of the elder Mutula from news reports at the time. Mutula went to SMU's film school, and an earlier effort, All Grit, No Quit, focused on the Mustangs' 2009 season and their first bowl win since the death penalty. With Pony Express, Mutula provides an entertaining look into the roller coaster ride of SMU football over the past 30 years, reminding older fans of those crazy days and giving younger fans a valuable history lesson. In the two decades following the death penalty, SMU had only one winning season, including 6 years when the team won only one game, and a winless season in 2003. So when Coach June Jones leads the team onto the field in the Armed Forces Bowl, the Ponies will have a lot to be thankful for, and college football will continue to have its darkest reminder of how far a team can fall.
Through 80 years of its existence, the Southwest Conference has arguably earned the right to be called one of the greatest college football conferences of all times. With legendary stars like Sammy Baugh, John David Crow, and Earl Campbell. Great coaches including Darryl Royal, Dutch Meyer, Frank Broyles. Memorable games such as the 1935 SMU versus TCU game. The 1956 TCU versus Texas A&M Hurricane game. And of course, the 1969 Big Shootout, pitting top-ranked Texas against number 2 Arkansas. Remembered by many as the game of the century.
Here's an article from the May 1994 issue of Texas Monthly entitled Seasons to Remember. The big games, great players, and agonizing setbacks that mark the rise and inevitable fall of the Southwest Conference. I told you so. I predicted the demise of the Southwest Conference in this magazine, and sure enough, 4 schools, Baylor, Texas, Texas A&M, and Texas Tech, are leaving the Southwest Conference to join the Big 8. I admit that the breakup took a little longer than I had expected. Richard Nixon was president when that article was written, and my timing was off in other ways. Baylor's last championship was closer in time to Custer's last stand than to us in 1974, I wrote. Guess who won the conference title that very season? Oh well, it was the right article, just the wrong year. In its heyday, however, the Southwest Conference was one of the institutions that defined Texas. The heated rivalries it created both divided us and bound us together. When SMU and TCU played for the 1935 National Championship, America's leading sports writer, Grantland Rice, wrote of SMU's 20-14 victory, "This tense, keyed-up crowd saw a 60-minute swirl of action that no other section of the country could even approach in the clash of two sectional teams." But the conference couldn't survive competition from pro football, recruiting raids by out-of-state universities, and cheating scandals in the 80s. Here is a nostalgic look at the great moments of the past, preserved at the Texas Sports Hall of Fame Museum in Waco, and the events involving each of the 8 conference schools that epitomize the rise and fall of the Southwest Conference. National reputation. Rise. Cheer, cheer. 1934, October 6th, is the day that the Southwest Conference gains credibility for the first time. Texas beats Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana, 7-6, handing the Irish their first loss ever in a season opener at home. At nearby Purdue, Rice upsets the Boilermakers, who have lost only 4 games in the previous 4 years. Never before has the Southwest Conference enjoyed such national prestige. Fall. Lost weekend. 1992. September 5th is the day that the Southwest Conference loses its last shred of credibility. On the opening weekend of the first season after Arkansas leaves the league, all Southwest Conference teams except the Aggies go down to defeat. Oklahoma is the only respectable opponent. The other losses are inflicted by teams that used to be patsies for the Southwest Conference: Louisiana Tech, Tulsa, Air Force, Tulane, Mississippi State, and New Mexico. Southern Methodist. Rise. The mighty Dokes, 1948 fan, in interest in the Mustangs is so high that SMU moves its home games from Owen B. Stadium on campus to the Cotton Bowl. Doak Walker leads the team to a 9-1-1 record and wins the Heisman Trophy. Fall. Homeward Bound. 1989. Fan interest in the Mustangs is so low that SMU moves back to Owen B. Stadium. In their first season after the NCAA death penalty, the Mustangs lose all 8 conference games, giving up 401 points. Rice. Rise. Magle Omania. 1954, Rice defeats Alabama in the Cotton Bowl, 28-6. Dickie Magle sets a record by rushing for 265 yards on 11 carries. He is headed for a 95-yard touchdown run when Tommy Lewis of Alabama jumps off the bench and tackles him. Between 1946 and 1957, Rice wins the Southwest Conference 4 times. It hasn't won since. Fall. Mob scene. 1973, Texas A&M fans, angry at a satiric halftime performance by the Marching Owl Band, known as the Mob, surround the musicians after the game and prevent them from leaving the stadium. Although Rice upsets A&M 24-20, the band gets more coverage than the football team. Things will only get worse. Rice will win only 7 conference games in the next 6 seasons. Texas Christian. Rise. Nifty 50s. 1959, TCU knocks off undefeated Texas 14-9. The Horned Frogs win their 2nd straight Southwest Conference championship and are the team of the decade for the 50s, with 4 titles. TCU will upset number 1 ranked Texas again in 1961, but they never win another conference championship. Fall. Hostile takeover. 1960 poachers invade TCU's territory. Texas Tech joins the Southwest Conference and captures TCU's favorite recruiting grounds in West Texas. The Cowboys arrive in Dallas, sign SMU's Don Meredith, and soon win the regional battle for media attention and fan support. TCU and SMU go into tailspins. Texas Tech. Rise. Sinking Arkansas. 1966, Texas Tech wins its first big conference game, upsetting Arkansas 21-16 and knocking the Razorbacks out of the Cotton Bowl. The next year, Tech will defeat Texas for the first time, but a last-second loss to A&M keeps the Red Raiders out of the Cotton Bowl. Fall. Last chance. 1976, Tech's best team goes 10-1 and ties for the conference championship. But its only loss is to Houston, and the Cougars get the Cotton Bowl invitation. The Red Raiders will never be a contender for the championship again. In 34 seasons as a member of the Southwest Conference, Tech has only one co-championship and no Cotton Bowl appearances. Texas. Rise. Royal Reception. 1969, Texas number one in the polls and Arkansas ranked second, play on the last day of the season for the conference title. Texas wins 15-14, helped by a daring fourth quarter pass, and secures the national championship by defeating Notre Dame in the Cotton Bowl. Darrell Royal is the coach of the year. Texas is on a run of 6 consecutive conference titles, 7 in 8 years. Fall. Royal Pain. 1976, Texas and Arkansas play the last game of the season again, this time to determine which team can avoid ending the season with a losing record. Darrell Royal announces his retirement before the game. Though he stays on as athletic director, he is not allowed to hire the next coach. Regents chairman and former governor Alan Shivers intervenes in favor of Fred Akers. The athletic department is split by politics, and the football program slowly deteriorates. Akers goes undefeated in his first season, but since 1977, Texas has won the conference championship only twice. Baylor. Rise. God's Squad. 1974. Baylor, 34. Texas, 24. The Bears win the conference championship for the first time in 50 years. The scoreboard stays lit all night as people drive by the stadium to see it. The wife of Baylor's president credits God for Baylor's victory, saying, "He's finally taking an interest in football." Baylor coach Grant Taft says, "I think we have proved that the private schools can compete in the Southwest Conference." But Baylor will win only one more title in the next 19 years. Fall. The way to San Jose. 1980, Baylor's best team ever goes 10-1, but fails to win credibility for the Southwest Conference by losing to San Jose State in the regular season and getting blown out by Alabama in the Cotton Bowl. The failure of Southwest Conference teams to do well against teams from other conferences will soon become a fatal trend. Houston, rise. High Cotton. 1979, Houston reigns as the dominant team in the conference and defeats Nebraska in the Cotton Bowl. In the 4 years since, joining the Southwest Conference in 1976, Houston has won 36 games, 3 championships, and 2 Cotton Bowls. Attendance averages 37,500 a game. Fall. Low blow. 1989, Houston 95, SMU 21. Never has a victory hurt a program more. Houston runs up the score on an inexperienced SMU team that is in its first year of play after the NCAA death penalty. Though Houston wins 28 games and loses only 5 from 1988 through 1990, it goes on probation for paying players, and the rout of SMU further establishes its reputation as an outlaw program. Fans don't come. Home attendance in 1988 was just 22,000 a game, and neither do recruits. In the next 3 years, Houston wins only 6 conference games. Texas A&M. Rise. Sonny and Cheryl. 1982. The future looks bright when Texas A&M hires new coach Jackie Sherrill at a salary of $287,000 a year. Aggie haters snicker as Sherrill struggles through 3 mediocre seasons. But from 1985 through 1988, the Aggies go 26-4 in conference games, win 3 championships, and defeat Texas all 4 years. Sherrill resigns when the Aggies go on probation, but he leaves the program in such good shape that A&M has finished first or second every year since. Fall. Poll axed. 1992. The Aggies go 12-0 in the regular season, but the conference has so little respect that they get no consideration in the polls as the number one team in the country. On New Year's Day, the Aggies' undefeated season ends with a 28-3 drubbing by Notre Dame, further eroding the Southwest Conference stature.
15 seconds here. Stand by all cameras.
Ready with slow motion and isolated cameras.
Stand by videotape and roll tape.
The tape is rolling in less than 5, in 3, 2, 1.
Take tape.
This is the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, Texas, as viewed from overhead by the Goodyear blimp, America. Tonight, it's the New York Giants and the Dallas Cowboys. Perfect weather for football. Both these clubs battling to stay close to the undefeated Washington Redskins. And NFL Monday Night Football is brought to you by Firestone. The name that's known is Firestone, where the rubber meets the road. And by Ford, who invites you to see all the 72 better ideas at your Ford dealers.
Over 60,000 people here in the Cotton Bowl tonight to see the Giants against the Dallas Cowboys. Hello again, everyone. I'm Howard Cosell. Welcome to another Monday night of NFL football.
Here's an article from the January 1988 issue of Texas Monthly entitled Texas Primer, the Cotton Bowl. First, the Cowboys left, then SMU. But the stadium remains as a monument to Texas football. The name itself speaks of a Texas of another era. Today we might call it the Semiconductor Bowl or the Free Enterprise Bowl. But in 1936, Texas was still a southern state and cotton was the ballgame. Something must have been in the air that year. Southern Methodist University had just claimed its first and only national championship, only to lose to Stanford 7-0 in the 1936 Rose Bowl. J. Curtis Sanford, a Tyler oil man, returned from that game determined that Texas would have its own New Year's Day contest, which would be held in the 6-year-old Fair Park Stadium, where Oklahoma and Texas were already playing every year. The Texas Centennial opened that summer on those same fairgrounds, and with that exposition, the state made its first tentative break away from the Old South. The Cotton Bowl Classic was born in that fertile moment when Texas was turning away from its defeated past and moving uncertainly toward its bright destiny. Sanford personally guaranteed $10,000 for the first bowl game, which saw Texas Christian University defeat Marquette 16-6. By 1940, when Boston College played Clemson and only 12,000 customers paid to attend, the Classic was being called Sanford's Folly. That spring, however, the Southwest Conference and the Cotton Bowl Association agreed that the conference winner would play host to the annual game, and out of that marriage came some of the most memorable moments in college football history. My favorite, the 1979 Ice Bowl, when a frozen Joe Montana sat out most of the third quarter drinking soup to bring his body temperature back to normal, while Notre Dame was losing by 22 points to Houston. Montana returned with 7 minutes and 25 seconds left in the game to lead Notre Dame to a 35-34 victory. The worst bowl game ever played may have been the 0-0 tie between Air Force and TCU in 1959. The weirdest one was the 1954 game in which Alabama's Tommy Lewis sprang off the bench to tackle Rice's Dickie Maigle. Rice won 28-6. Until the 40s, the stadium seated at little more than 46,000 patrons on redwood bleachers, which were adequate until Doak Walker became a sophomore All-American and undefeated SMU appeared in its first Cotton Bowl Classic in 1948. SMU started playing its home games in the Cotton Bowl later that year. That was the beginning of the glory days for college football and the Southwest Conference in particular. No one better typified the clean-living, fair-playing sportsman than Doak Walker, and second tier of seats was added to accommodate his fans. The next school year, Walker won the Heisman Trophy, and the stadium was enlarged again to a capacity of 75,504. In 1960, the Cotton Bowl suddenly became host to two professional football teams, the Dallas Cowboys of the National Football League and the Dallas Texans of the now-defunct American Football League. It was the Texans I gave my heart to. With hundreds of other teenagers, I joined the Huddle Club, which cost $1 for a season ticket. There was a nice air of unimportance about professional football back then. In 1963, however, the Texans went to Kansas City and became the Chiefs, and the Cowboys had Dallas to themselves. Very quickly, they began to demand a new stadium. The Cotton Bowl was too large, almost impossible to fill. Plus, it was sitting in the middle of a black neighborhood. Many of the Cowboys' fans back then were blacks and lower-class whites for whom professional football was cheap and convenient entertainment. The city of Dallas, which owns the Cotton Bowl, tried to mollify Cowboys owner Clinton Murchison by installing plastic bench seats and reducing the capacity to its present size of 72,013. Nevertheless, in 1971, Murchison moved his team to his new stadium in Irving, the one with the silly donut hole in the roof. 8 years later, SMU also deserted the house that Doak built for the one that Clint built, and the Cotton Bowl fell into its current state of disuse. Oh, rock concerts and evangelists still come. Grambling State and Prairie View A&M play a game there every year. There's always the Cotton Bowl Classic, although with the decline and disgrace of the Southwest Conference, the game is usually eclipsed by the Rose, Sugar, and Orange Bowls, and sometimes by the Fiesta Bowl as well. Even OU has been talking about playing half its games with UT in Norman. The stadium remains, though, as a monument to a different era of football and a different Texas.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear Recording Library.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
Coronavirus Briefs. The West Texas Food Bank has resumed business with a few modifications, according to a press release. The senior pantry at the Midland location will continue to operate 10 a.m. to noon, Tuesday and Thursday, and the emergency pantry at the Odessa facility will continue normal operations on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Clients will be asked to drive through, and WTFB staff will load groceries into their vehicles.
Sure, Paula Deen and Guy Fieri are experts in the kitchen, but would they be able to pull off their delicious recipes if they had no eyesight? Dale Campbell may have lost his vision, but he didn't lose his creativity. Each week, Dale and co-host Cheryl Cummings bring you new recipes and cooking tips, specifically for those who have low vision or no vision on Cooking in the Dark. Wednesdays at 8, Sundays at noon, and Mondays at midnight on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 68 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus Updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
It's make-believe ballroom time. Put all your cares away. All the bands are here to bring good cheer your way. It's make-believe ballroom time, and free to everyone. It's no time to fret, your dial is set for fun. Just close your eyes and visualize in your solitude. Your favorite bands are on the stands, and Mr. Miller puts you in the mood. It's make-believe ballroom time. The hour of sweet romance. Here's your make-believe ballroom. Come on, children, let's dance, let's dance.
Hi, folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the make-believe ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world and welcome to the ballroom, and thank you for joining me this hour as we listen to some wonderful swing, jazz, and big band music, as well as many of the stories behind the records I play. In just a moment, how two iconic big band leaders got their regal names. But first, I haven't played any Charlie Barnett in some time, so I'm going to open the ballroom this week with Barnett and his Knocking at the Famous Door, recorded on the Bluebird label in 1939, direct from my Victrola turntable on the console here in the Crystal Studio. Nicknames. First, let's talk about Edward Kennedy Ellington. Edward was given the nickname of Duke early in life, and it was said he became Duke due to his suave nature and classy manners. But here's a historic fact you may not know about another nickname he had, which you may be hearing today for the first time on the Make Believe Ballroom. Duke Ellington was also called Dumpy, yes, Dumpy, by some of his sidemen
due to his alleged eating habits. Ellington always did his best to look good, but he had a potentially huge appetite that led his trombonist Tricky Sam Nanton to once say, quote unquote, "He's a genius, all right, but Jesus, how he eats." Ellington found that when he went on a diet consisting of nothing but steak, hot water, grapefruit juice, and coffee, he could lose weight very quickly. But during periods when he was eating excessively, Ellington knew just the right clothes to wear that could keep him looking slim no matter what his weight, and therefore maintain with pride the moniker of Duke with the regal grace it deserved. Duke Ellington and the orchestra with Harlem Airshaft, recorded on RCA Victor, July the 22nd, 1940. Basie got the nickname Count in Kansas City back in 1936 while he was playing at a place called the Reno Club. He was only known as Bill Basie at that time. So one night during a local remote broadcast, the announcer called Bill to the microphone for the usual few words of introduction on the radio, and he commented that Bill Basie was a rather ordinary name, and further that